The Gospel of Mark begins in a hurry. There's no annunciation to Mary, no painful trek to Bethlehem, not even a single shepherd watching over his grazing sheep. The narrator has no time for any of that, it seems, and John the Baptizer appears in the wilderness, breathless, and gathering a crowd. "Prepare for God's arrival," he says. "Make crooked paths straight," he continues. "Put on a whole new mind," which is what repentance really means. And now he has my attention and everybody else in earshot who's sick and tired of being sick and tired. And suddenly, Jesus comes from Nazareth and is baptized in the Jordan. And just as he is coming up out of the water, he sees the heavens torn apart. The verb here is schizo, which means to rip open or separate. And it's as if the universe itself is a mirror of the work this one has come to accomplish. There will no longer be poor nor rich, tyrant nor slave, nor any great nor small, nor kings nor leaders, but all alike in common. That's good news if you're looking for economic solidarity and common purpose. Good news for the healing of families and nations. Good news for the redemption of religion and systems and individuals. And hard truth if you're committed to the way things are and to clutching your little piece of the sky. To a people accustomed to their ways and their walls, Jesus breaks open their consciousness, ours too, if we have ears to hear him. Outsider becomes insider. Broken becomes blessed. Women and men are equal. Race and tribe are illusions, and every kind of captive will be set free. After calling his first four disciples, Simon and Andrew, who immediately leave their nets, and James and John, who immediately leave their father in the boat with the hired man, Jesus returns to Capernaum, a tiny backwater reported to be his hometown and that of five of his inner circle. If we visited there today, we'd encounter some very impressive ruins, an ancient Byzantine monastery, and what's left of a 4th-century synagogue with columns and massive stone walls. But in the first century, the place where Mark has Jesus begin his ministry, it was by all reports a one-horse town. At that time, about 1,000 people lived on 25 acres of land, which, to give some local context, is about 2.5 times the size of Redeemer's campus. There was no Greco-Roman architecture in Capernaum, suggesting a significant urban center. No gates, no defensive fortifications, no theater or coliseum. No public bathhouse, no basilica for public gatherings or commercial activities, no market. The streets were not paved. There's no evidence of a sewage system, no plaster surfaces or decorative frescoes, no marble of any kind, no ceramic tiles. The mostly single-story houses were built with small, local stones, crooked beams, straw, reeds, and mud, and they had thatched roofs. The town's location beside the Sea of Galilee supported a fishing industry, but it must have been a humble one because there is no evidence anywhere of wealth. According to historian John Dominic Crossan, the only thing Capernaum was good for was as a place to get away from. You get the picture? It's on the map because Jesus taught there at the synagogue, and it's where three stories of healing occur. Peter's mother-in-law, the servant of a Roman centurion, and the man in today's gospel. That's where it all gets started for Jesus in this version of the gospel, so I invite you to picture your own experience of a backwater town and how you were invited to feel there. You might begin with a physical place, North Carolina, or Mississippi, or Arkansas, or some small corner of Baltimore, or the county. Maybe it's your high school, or a classroom in the 7th grade. It might even be a bustling city or a Fortune 500 company, but for one reason or another, you felt small there, left out, like you were missing something. It's likely to be an emotional space within that place, some part of your experience on the margin, where you were discounted or dishonored or dismissed. And that's where the story of Jesus' healing begins. As the scene opens, Jesus is teaching with authority, which astounds the congregants. He doesn't sound like someone who just copied the text several times and memorized it, they murmur. He knows the text like a rabbi, you can hear them saying. And just then, there was in their synagogue a man with an unclean spirit, which cried out, "What have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." Amazing, everyone, Jesus addresses the unclean spirit directly. "Be silent," he says, "and come out of him." And the crowd speaks again of his authority. "What is this? A new teaching," they exclaim. "This one will engage even our deepest brokenness." And here's what I find stunningly new. Jesus makes it clear that the man is not unclean. Only the bedeviling spirit which enslaves him is the problem. Now, we might use different language than Mark employs, but most of us know we are possessed by many things that it would help us to exercise: pride, anger, self-doubt, grief. Virtually all of us have behaviors with which we struggle, addictions and compulsions, large and small. We often know what's best for us, yet we still choose something less good. So, like the man in the story, we need help to distinguish between the cage and us. Some power that sees us for who we are and calls out the demon who diminishes us. A God who loves us despite our worst thoughts and acts. Back in Capernaum, that dreary place on the margins where you feel separated from who you want to be, small, poor, lost, unknown, God comes there, in the darkest part of the dark, on the backside of beyond, in the midst of death. God comes and calls us out to live. No wonder Mark is in a hurry. Do we have any time to lose? Kathleen Norris was 12 years old when her family was transferred to Hawaii. Her father was called as the director of the Navy band at Pearl Harbor in 1959, just after that island paradise became our 50th state. But for Kathleen, Honolulu couldn't have been a more godforsaken backwater. At a meeting with the school principal, her parents realized that she and her brother would be using textbooks that they'd used and finished 2 years before. So the children were placed in an independent school started 100 years earlier by missionaries for their children. Kathleen writes, "By mid-afternoon on my first day in the seventh grade, I thought that things were working out. But as I was sitting in a bathroom stall, I heard several girls enter the room. I think there were three of them. And to my chagrin, it quickly became obvious that they were talking about me in the most unflattering terms. They busily dissected me, mocking my hair, my weight, my shoes, my clothes, my voice, and my manner until one of them noticed my shoes in the stall. 'Oh my goodness, she's in here,' Kathleen heard a voice whisper, and then the furtive sounds of a hurried exit." Kathleen noted, "A few moments into the bathroom had taught me that this was decidedly their school and that I was the unwelcome stranger." And she continues, "What happens to so many 12-year-olds and so is so unspeakably worse that this story hardly seems worth telling. The dislocation and loneliness that any child in a new school might feel is nothing out of the ordinary. But what is extraordinary is the effect it had on me." She says, "I had to struggle with myself not to run away that afternoon. I refused to let my enemies know, already they had become my enemies, how deeply they had wounded me. But the emotional armor I had to don to enter that classroom, it became a chip on my shoulder, a resolve to endure whatever my classmates could dish out." And her resiliency is the bright side, but the shadow side is the anger that she built, with which she built a carapace around her innermost self that went on to shape her adolescence. She accepted her role as the outsider, internalized it, and what started as resolve became resentment, which Kathleen carried to her adulthood. As a young bride, her spouse asked her if she knew how sharp her tongue could be, how cutting her anger. And at that moment, she acknowledged the demon she had nursed inside her for all those years. Addressing the spirit directly started her on the road to healing. "I'm not so mean anymore," she says. And when my grandchildren became students at my old school, I told them that they were just not allowed to make some child feel like she'd been kicked to the margins. And they couldn't believe that Grandma had been hurt once, and so badly. I found an old letter from a friend this week. He wrote, "How's your brother? Is he making progress? Have you been spending much time with him? It's been a rough stretch for me personally these last few weeks," he wrote, "and death and dying have been an unfortunate thing. I had a 3-year-old patient die from a brain tumor. My aunt passed away, and a good friend went into hospice care, all within a 3-week space. It really makes you reevaluate when so much sadness prevails." His letter went on, "I left the funeral of my patient and pulled my 5-year-old out of daycare to get an ice cream. He was bewildered by my presence and couldn't fully grasp why I was visiting him on a work day. When I scooped him up and embraced him in a hug with tears streaming down my cheeks, he started laughing. 'Daddy, you're joking with me. You're happy to see me, not sad.' I was so overwhelmingly happy to see him and couldn't at the moment explain my tears, so I just hugged him and laughed right along with him. So it's been one of those stretches of soul searching," he said. "Always a good thing and always leads me back to you in my thoughts. It really is all part of the journey, and each moment like this or stretch of sadness gives me perspective. It reinforces the importance of midday ice cream trips, extra hugs, less cell phone time, and more laughter. Easier said than done, but the reminders are important. I hope this letter finds you well and your brother healing." We may not call them demons anymore, but every one of us knows about getting caught up in a spirit that's not healthy for us, too busy or distracted, running this way or that. Or we're caught off guard by old demons that live inside us, and we're shocked to fathom the depth of their power and our sorrow. Look back at the man possessed in today's scripture. It's in the God-forsaken places that Jesus comes to him, right where we least expect to be touched or heard or welcomed. God is there. And that embrace begins to heal us when we let ourselves lean back into it and rest a while there. God embraces all and excludes no one, even our unclean spirits. His life says, there is no them, there is only us. Maybe we can have the courage to live that way, too. In the darkest part of the dark, on the backside of beyond, in the midst of even death, God comes and calls us out to live.